Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Stephen Tagle about his essay, Notes on Looking Back, which appeared in issue 22 of The Common. Stephen Tagle is the recipient of fellowships from the Institute of Current World Affairs, Asian American Writers Workshop, Lambda Literary, and Fulbright Greece, as well as a Soros Fellowship for New Americans. A graduate of the UMass Amherst MFA program, he has been published in the Los Angeles Review of Books, The Rumpus, Hobart, Them, and Nea Estia. Originally from California, he now lives in Greece. Stephen Tagle, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Emily. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. It's so terrific to be on the other side of this.
Would you set the scene for our conversation? Just describe sort of where you're living, where you're calling from.
Yeah, of course. So I'm speaking to you from Alexandroupoli, which is a city in the most northeastern corner of Greece. It's a place, a part of the mainland that most Americans and many Greeks have not been. It's bordered by Bulgaria and Turkey, and Alexandroupoli is sort of a small little town with just pretty much one main street along the sea and then one north-south street, and you know, it's a small, quiet little town with bike lanes, and there's a large police and soldier presence because they kind of guard the border. But it has all the necessities that you would need, lots of cute little places to eat and have coffee. And it's sort of the gateway to, these kind of beautiful, little villages in the most northeast corner of Greece.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. That is a very exotic locale to be calling from for a podcast. I would love if you would start us off with a reading from your essay. Would you do the first few paragraphs for us?
Of course, I'd be happy to. Okay, so these are the first two paragraphs of Notes on Looking Back. Last year, I wandered through Greece, knocking on all the gates of Hades. I walked along the Acheron River, whose icy blue waters seemed colored by the spirits of the dead. Stalactites dripped onto the back of my neck as a silent boatman ferried me through the caves of Dyros. I searched for the entrance to the sea cave at Cape Tanaron, scrambling over sharp rocks below the lighthouse as darkness fell. Sometimes I wondered if my search for the underworld tempted the fates. I remembered Orpheus, the father of music, who charmed beasts with his lyre and descended into Tenaron to find his lost bride, Eurydice. With song, he implored Hades and Persephone to bring her back to life, and his words moved the deathless gods to tears. They granted his wish, allowing him to lead her out of the underworld on one condition. He must walk ahead of her, not looking back until they left the dark halls of death. Approaching the surface, the farthest reach of light, Orpheus feared his love's silence behind him. He turned to look and saw her sink back to the depths, reaching out to him and bidding him farewell for the last time. Retelling this myth, I'm amazed that in Greek, the word death, thanatos, has not changed in almost three millennia. Homer used the same word in the 8th century BCE to describe the warriors who fell like leaves in the Iliad. He called the sea thalassa and man andra, just as Greeks do today. I have traveled extensively through Greece to visit mythological sites, but Greek mythology exists within the language too. Modern Greek evolved from ancient Greek, so it retains a connection to the Olympian gods that then passed into English. For example, the word panic, panikos in Greek, has its roots in the name of the god Pan and means sudden and unexplained fear or awe, the same feeling that the protector of shepherds and hunters inspires in those who enter his realm. The words music, musiki in Greek, and museum, museo, come from the nine muses, goddesses of the arts and sciences, the source of inspiration for poets, dancers, and musicians.
Thank you so much for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your essay yet, would you just describe generally what the piece is about?
Yeah, sure. So this essay is sort of a love letter to Greece and also to the Greek language. It's about my love and fascination for the sounds that certain letters and certain combinations of letters make in Greek words, and also how many Greek words sort of, if you break them up into their roots and suffixes and prefixes, they create a story that describe the meaning of each word. And the essay is also an exploration of how living in Greece has transformed me personally and how it's transformed my writing.
That's great. I know you originally wrote this essay a few years ago now, but, you know, before the pandemic. And of course, after 2 years of pandemic life, it was such a pleasure to read about these travels that you have around Greece and all the meeting new people and being adopted by families and invited to holiday meals. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about how Greece has weathered the pandemic, like what it's been like there.
Yeah, of course. So I feel like Greece, I was very impressed by how Greece handled the pandemic. I feel like Greece is a small country, and I think at the beginning of the pandemic, you wouldn't have expected this sort of really comprehensive response that the Greek government has made. But, even before the first case was found in Greece, there was a plan put in action where they identified certain hospitals throughout the country that would take in COVID patients. There was a big jump in sort of digitization of kind of government services and COVID-related processes during the pandemic. So, for example, during the lockdown, which began in March, we had to send a text message to the government in order to go grocery shopping, to go to to the grocery store or to a pharmacy. And that kind of, I guess, tracked how many people were out at any one time and sort of made sure that there weren't too many people out in a specific area. And then also with the vaccination campaign, they have this really kind of high-tech system where you can just really very easily make an appointment online, find a place near you that has appointments available and schedule your appointment. And then they give you a digital certificate that you can keep on your phone so that in order to enter a cafe, most indoor spaces, a restaurant, a movie theater, you have to show your vaccination certificate. So they have this app that scans your QR code and validates your certificate. And so they check each person who enters an indoor space like that, which is, makes you feel really, really comfortable, like really safe.
Mm. That's great. Wow. I mean, that seems like that has been a fairly good place to weather the pandemic.
It has. I mean, the only thing is that you're right. It has been really hard to travel, especially during lockdown. You weren't allowed to leave your kind of region or prefecture. So I, you know, for example, I had this really little apartment in Athens, and I specifically got an apartment that small because I thought I would be traveling all the time. But during the pandemic, for about, you know, a year and a half, I was stuck in that little apartment, sitting at my kitchen table all day, and that was a big change from the lifestyle that you read about in my essay.
Yes. So just because I'm really curious, can you tell us how you ended up living in Greece? Like, did you first go on a Fulbright?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's kind of amazing because 5 years ago, before I came to Greece on my Fulbright, I knew relatively little about the country. I mean, my idea of it was, you know, the Acropolis, you know, Mykonos and Santorini, kind of the most basic, and Greek mythology, which I've loved ever since I was little. Mm-hmm. So the project that I proposed for my Fulbright was to visit places in Greece related to Greek myths. And that connected to my writing because when I was during my final years in the MFA program at UMass Amherst, I was really thinking about how to retell Greek myths and fairy tales and to sort of queer them or to explore other issues of identity that aren't usually covered in these older myths. So how to refresh them, how to renew them, and also how to use them to explore personal narratives in the metaphorical sense. So I became really invested in these myths, which I've loved since I was a kid. And during my Fulbright, it was such a powerful experience to visit these dramatic landscapes in Greece. I think people, you know, unless you've traveled a lot in Greece, it's hard to understand just how diverse the landscapes are here. In addition to the islands and the beaches, there are mountains, there are gorges, waterfalls. There are some islands that are much greener. There are islands that are more desert-like. And I think one thing that I really discovered is that it makes sense why the ancient Greeks created gods that were related to natural phenomena, because the natural elements of the country, its dramatic cliffs and powerful sunsets and kind of its rivers, its waterfalls, they have such a visceral power. And, you know, if you go to an olive grove where the olive trees are like thousands of years old and they're huge and gnarled, they have this physical presence where you could see how they could be related to nymphs or to satyrs or to gods. So I was really overwhelmed by the nature in Greece.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. I bet you're right. You know, that they would see all those things and put them into their myths and into their gods. I'm sort of curious, like, what do you think would surprise people about life in Greece, like either your daily life or the daily life of people in Greece?
I would say, I feel like in some ways, I mean, one thing that really surprised me is just how welcoming people are. The sense of philoxenia or Greek hospitality, it's something that you hear about, but to see it in action and to find kind of be welcomed by people here was something that it always continues to surprise me. Like, for example, today I went up to these villages in the northern part of Evros, because today is the Theophania or Epiphany, and it's sort of a religious holiday. But there are certain traditions that the different villages have. Usually, in most places, there's sort of this diving for the cross. So a priest will go to a beach, a port, a river, and they will give a blessing and sort of bless the waters, and they will throw a cross into the water. And then you have like a group of young men usually who dive into the water to retrieve the cross. And it has to do with the blessing of the water, with sort of water being related to life. And especially for farmers here, and there's a lot of agriculture in this area. So it's sort of really important for the annual cycle of the crops and for kind of the cycle of life in the new year. So I went up to this village called Dadia, and I didn't know anyone, but you know, one of the president of the Ethnological Museum here in Alexandroupoli gave me this tip. She was like, you know, they're doing a very rare tradition today in this village, so you have to go. So I went with my camera. I just kind of showed up at the church at 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made a couple of friends who just after, you know, they saw that I was new there, they invited me for coffee. And we hung out throughout the day and followed these activities that were happening in the village. I went to this this woman's house, and her mother fed me. And I'm going to go back, I think, in 2 weeks for another traditional kind of feast or tradition. And so there's just this way, I mean, no matter how many times it happens, and people have been so hospitable to me in the years since I've been here, it's just, I think it's always still such a surprise. And so kind of, they're so different from anything I'm used to experiencing. Just the way that people will sort of enfold you into their lives and kind of take you under their wing.
Yeah, it sounds kind of magical, honestly. I definitely got that. Yeah, I definitely got that sense, you know, reading your essay, that the way that people would be so welcoming, it sounds lovely. There is so much love of Greece and for the Greek language in this piece, and it really reads like a love letter to those things. And I enjoy the inclusion of mythology, as you mentioned, those figures sort of drifting in and out of the piece. What inspired you to start work on this essay?
So I began this essay in 2018 when I was living in New York. I had just finished my Fulbright, and I'd come back to finish a fellowship with the Asian American Writers Workshop. And so I just come back from Greece, and I was missing it so much. And I was also kind of afraid that I was quickly losing the Greek language skills that I developed during my year in Greece. So I think that fear, that longing to return, and also reading Jhumpa Lahiri's book, In Other Words, in which she describes her efforts to learn Italian, and she wrote the book in Italian and it was translated into English. You know, reading about, you know, sort of her daring to do that motivated me to try my hand at it in Greek and see what would come out, because until then I'd really mostly used Greek as sort of an everyday tool to get by, to speak with people, but I hadn't really tried to use the language in a more artistic and considered way. And so, you know, I had also always wanted to do some translation from Greek into English or from English into Greek. And I'd never thought that I had reached a point where I felt comfortable doing that. But for some reason, sort of using my own words or experiences as material made it seem easier for me to take that leap. And so I think that combination of things, it was an exercise to keep my Greek up and a way to connect with this country that I felt so sort of indebted to and have felt such a connection to.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, I love that. So normally this is where I would ask if the piece came together quickly or not, but you also, you sort of tangle with that process right in the text of the essay itself. You talk about sort of free writing the first draft and enjoying the words and then not wanting to revise it, then struggling to revise it. What can you tell us about the process of writing this, sort of writing an essay, but also writing in a second language, just in general?
Yes. I mean, it was a, you know, it took about a year or a little bit longer than a year. And I think it was a process that covered a gamut of emotions. There was sort of this euphoria or this freedom of being able to write in Greek, even though I was writing slowly. And I also, for this essay, I sort of changed up my writing process in that I was writing on my iPad, and usually I had my iPad and then I had my Greek English dictionary next to me, and I would just kind of turn back and forth from one to another. Mm-hmm. And the reason I was writing on my iPad is because I could write on the keyboard there in Google Docs, and the Apple iOS would help me with the autocomplete of the word. So that made it much easier to write in Greek and to write sort of correctly without misspellings. I think when I type in Word on my computer, I feel much more alone.
So that's so interesting.
There was that kind of sort of technological thing that helped process-wise. I was just kind of like, you know, typing very slowly, sort of with two fingers, pretty much. And I was kind of writing at the pace of thinking, because in Greek, I feel like I formed the sentences more slowly. And so I was able to sort of keep the pace in that way. And so then it felt like, after a while, it felt like an essay that I could just keep writing and writing and just keep adding paragraphs to. And there was this really interesting phenomenon where if I spent too much time away from a certain part of the essay, it would sort of translate itself back out of my understanding. So after a while, these paragraphs that I had written would kind of become mysterious to me again, or become almost undecipherable. So there was sort of this time, I felt like there was this time pressure to finish the essay before I sort of forgot what exactly I had written. I think what I struggled most with was to sort of look at the essay, kind of step back from the essay, look at it holistically, and then figure out what would be a fitting end for the piece. Because it sort of took me out of having my face so close to the essay and just sort of creating new material, but then having to step back and sort of synthesize it, which I guess I wasn't, I didn't have experience doing in Greek, and then sort of finding a way to structurally bring it to a close. So that's what I struggled with in the last few months.
Well, the good news is you came to a great ending.
Thank you.
So you have so many publications, and it really feels like you've been living the writer life for years, you know, since you graduated. I wonder if you have any advice for emerging writers sort of thinking about what a life committed to writing really looks like.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I feel like I'm still figuring that out in many ways, but I feel like one of my instructors, my undergrad writing instructors from Stanford told me that the writing life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. So, you know, take your time with your work, take time, building experiences, which are sort of the foundation for my writing, at least. And since I've been in Greece, I've tried every day to sort of keep a journal of what I observe, people I meet, things I witness. And that has kind of grown into multiple Google Docs of these sort of captain's logs. I feel like the writing life is harder than I imagined it would be when I first started out. You have to deal with a lot of rejection, a lot of time just by yourself, sitting with your butt in your chair and trying to make something work. And I think the thrilling thing and the frustrating thing about writing is that the challenges that you face are always different. You know, every piece of writing presents new challenges, and that's why writing is always exciting, and it's also why it can be frustrating.
Yes.
And I think as a writer, you are constantly walking this tightrope between time and money. You need to have enough time to write and devote to your craft. And at the same time, you have to put food on the table. So for me, you know, I've sort of vacillated between going on these year or 2 year long fellowships, which I've been very fortunate to receive from different organizations, but also, you know, trying to find work that will satisfy me creatively, will also give me enough time to work on my own work. And you know, it's a constant challenge, but I think you for many writers, I think it's writing is a sort of necessity. It's not a luxury. And so I think you make time to do the work so that you can express yourself and connect with other people. And that is its own reward, I think.
So you write across a lot of different genres. You've done some more journalistic work, and you write fiction and poetry too. And one thing I read of yours just in preparing for this that really stayed with me was an essay about the time you spent with refugees in a camp in Greece. It was really, really moving. And I wondered if you'd just talk a little bit about that piece and that experience.
Yeah, sure. So this essay, which was published in the Los Angeles Review of Books, it's called Under the Shadow Flag, A Week in the Basilica Refugee Camp. And this was actually one of the first experiences I had during my Fulbright when I moved to Greece. I went up with a group of friends to Thessaloniki, and there was a camp just outside of the city where refugees were being kept. And what was amazing to me was that it felt like a completely different world from Thessaloniki, which is Greece's second largest city. It's a city by the sea. It's beautiful, has great food and dessert, you know, but the camp was its own small sort of enclosed world. It was, I think, built on, it was like an old factory that was sort of like a military camp. And there were lines of tents inside of these sort of abandoned bunkers or warehouses. And there was sort of a makeshift day camp that this NGO had built across the street in sort of this yard. And they offered they had a women's space, they had a they created a little kitchen where the refugees could come and cook, and also different activities for the young children who were living in the camp. And so we went there for a week. It was a group of us, and we helped out at the camp, taught a little bit of English, participated in the activities that they held there. But we were also trying to, speak with the migrants, learn about their journeys, and see what they had in mind for their futures, like what their hopes were, and why they had decided to make this really difficult journey. And I took my camera there. I took a lot of photos while I was there, and you get to make really strong relationships with the people you meet there as well. I think I was just blown away by the way that these families would invite us into their tents, make us tea, offer us whatever food they had. I think even though they didn't have much, there was also with them this really strong sense of hospitality, and that, we were sort of entering their home, and they kept their tents as clean as possible. They were constantly sweeping the floor, cleaning the dishes. And this space really did feel like a little home. And so we got to know this family really well. And the nice thing was that I was able to keep up with them throughout my Fulbright. Like when they moved to Athens at one point, and they were staying in an apartment not far from where I was staying. And I took the two little kids out to see the Star Wars movie.
Awesome.
That came out. And so it's been really nice to be able to keep in touch with them, even after this experience.
Wow, that's so interesting to hear. I'm going to link to that essay in the show notes, because like you said, the photos you took were beautiful, and it's a great essay.
Thank you so much, Emily.
So I'm sure our listeners won't know this. You sort of mentioned it in the beginning, but you were once, long ago before my time, an intern at The Common, and you spearheaded the launch of The Common's first podcast series, which was called Contributors in Conversation. I feel like what we're doing now is really like the reboot of that. what can you tell us about your time at The Common and about working on the podcast?
So I had such a great time working at The Common. It's when I started my MFA program in 2013, I really wanted to gain some experience working for a really cool literary magazine. And I was so fortunate to connect with Jen. I think at this time, The Common had maybe four or five issues out at that point, but it already had this very distinct style. From the beginning, it had these really eye-catching, colorful covers that focused on a single object. I read the first couple issues, and the work in there really grabbed me, because I think a sense of place is something that's really overlooked in fiction, but something that contributes so much to the environment and the atmosphere of an essay or a story. And so I was really, really excited to be a part of the magazine. And at first I was working as the publicity and events coordinator. And so I was putting on different events in Amherst for launches of the magazine. And so in that way, it helped me to get to know the community in Northampton and in Amherst. And then I was talking with Jen, and we were really excited about putting together a podcast as another way of engaging with the material in the magazine, to provide sort of extra information, extra insight into the pieces in each mm-hmm. issue. And for me, it was so exciting to be able to connect with the contributors through the podcast, because I love the work that was published so much. And so it also gave me this extra insight to be able to speak with them and to help to put together the podcast. I think the way that we were doing it was more complicated than so it was a little bit difficult to do all the editing and the cutting down and things like that. But I'm so happy that you sort of resurrected it, and I think this format is really, really great.
Oh, thanks. I definitely feel like the thing that I get out of it is that opportunity to engage again, like you said, with the material, because, you know, we spend so long working on this material, especially the material and the issue, you know, it goes through so many edits and we love it so much. And then it goes out into the world and you don't really get to talk about it again with people. So, it's such a treat to be able to follow up with the authors of that work, you know, 3 months or 6 months after it came out and dive into it again and hope that other people will do the same. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think it really also inspires sort of a deeper dive into the material and additional discussions about issues related to each piece in the magazine. So I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so one last question. What are you working on now? Like, what's next from you?
So the reason that I'm in Alexandroupoli is because I am on a fellowship right now with this organization in Washington, D.C. called the Institute of Current World Affairs. It's a very small organization, but they've been around for about 100 years. And each year they choose two or three people to send anywhere in the world to pursue a project for 2 years. So right now there's a fellow in India, there's a fellow in Turkey, there's a fellow in West Africa, and then there's me in Greece. And so I have 2 years to pursue a project in Greece of my choosing. And I decided that I wanted to do a deep dive into Greece's borders, because I've spent most of my time living in the two biggest cities in Greece, Athens and Thessaloniki in the north. But I really wanted to get a sense of what life is like sort of on the periphery, and especially in islands and sort of in villages that border other countries that have experienced a sort of trends of migration, mixing of cultures. And I think that Greece is also this really... It's in this very strategic place in the Eastern Mediterranean at the crossroads between Europe, Eurasia, and Africa. And so historically, there's been a lot of movement across Greece and across the modern borders of Greece. So as part of this is a writing fellowship. So every month I publish a dispatch or an essay about something I've learned during the month in each of these places. So I'm spending 8 months in Evros and Alexandroupoli, 8 months in the northeastern Aegean islands of Chios and Lesvos, and then 8 months in Crete. So my first couple, I started this fellowship in October, and my first couple dispatches have been sort of an introduction to the province of Evros, an exploration of the historical and cultural ties between Istanbul and Thrace. And then I have an article that's coming out in a couple of days, which will be about the port of Alexandroupoli, the increased U.S. military presence there, and how that investment is providing new opportunities for locals there. So for the next 2 years, I'll be writing these dispatches every month. And I also really want to collect material for a book over the next 2 years. So that's what
I was going to say. That sounds like a book. It should be a book. where are those?
That's my goal.
Good. I'm glad. Where are those dispatches and essays published? They're online?
Yeah, they're online at icwa.org. And so there's a page for each of the fellows, and you can find my dispatches there.
Great. We will definitely link to that. That sounds so great. A brilliant project. Stephen Tagle, thanks so much for joining us. It's been really great talking with you.
Emily, it's been a blast. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Listeners, you can read Stephen's essay, Notes on Looking Back, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.